WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
The question occurs on the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson of the District of Columbia to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. On this vote, the yeas are 53, the nays are 47, and this nomination is confirmed.
Ketanji Brown Jackson won the support of several Republicans in the Senate to finalize her nomination as a Supreme Court justice. But the confirmation hearings along the way featured political grandstanding of the most blatant and even racist kind. Jane Mayer has been writing about the Supreme Court for years for The New Yorker, and we're joined as well by Anita Hill, who's a professor of social policy and law at Brandeis University. Anita and Jane, thanks so much for joining us. Now, the nomination process for Ketanji Brown Jackson, although successful in the end, was grueling and at times extremely ugly. Anita, you faced the Senate Judiciary Committee in your time during a very different nominating process. What was going through your mind as you watched those hearings?
Well, first, just let me make very clear. I was a witness in a confirmation hearing. Ketanji Brown Jackson is the nominee. I wasn't surprised that there was an attack on her. I was shocked at the level or the depths that they would go to discredit her. So I think we need to think about the cumulative impact that it has on her as the first African-American woman to be nominated for the Supreme Court position, but also the effect that it will have on her and her colleagues, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, as they begin leadership of what will be very likely a minority group on the Supreme Court. There's an even larger impact on the court itself, the credibility of the court. And the process for selecting judges was on trial. And I think damage was done to all of those.
Jane, you're a close watcher of the Senate. How is this nomination compared in tone and substance to the hearings prior to it, the hearings for Justice Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett?
Well, I mean, I found it just strikingly and depressingly familiar, particularly to the confirmation hearings of Clarence Thomas and the way that Anita Hill was treated. I have to say that is the echo that I kept hearing in this. And to some extent, Christine Blasey Ford, and as Anita Hill saying, these were witnesses. But what the salient thing to me was just the kind of just demeaning and And in fact, also something, an interesting theme to me was that there was a kind of a weird sexualization in all of these attacks, where the women were made to look sort of outside of the norms. I mean, in particular, I thought it was interesting that they went after Justice Jackson on her handling of sexual offenders and particularly sort of child pornography cases, and made her look permissive in some way, as if she was sort of somehow outside of the norms. And so Anita Hill, way back in the day, was described as an erotomaniac and described as sort of nutty and slutty and all these awful things that were, they were white men who were casting women as being sort of somehow dangerous in the sexual area. I found that, you know, just depressingly familiar.
Yeah, and I would definitely echo all of what you've said. The sexualization part, it is a way of sort of denigrating women. And it was all done, I said, from this associational baggage that they were sort of piling on her. She was associated with pedophilia because they disagreed with a sentence that she gave to one individual. And not only does that sexualize her, it feeds into these QAnon conspiracy theories about Democrats and pedophilia that have been swirling around, I guess, at least now for the past 4 or 5 years. And so it was easier for the sexualization to stick because she is a Black woman. And that has been the history of the treatment of Black women, over-sexualizing us for political reasons. And in this case, we see it at its highest level in our government, or maybe at its lowest level. But it's coming out of, you know, our Senate, and it is reflecting on our highest court.
Well, we see a moment. It is an accumulation of moments of Senator Cotton, Senator Hawley, Senator Cruz, Blackburn, and the accumulation of things seem to be what we would have thought were fringe attacks. All of these accumulate to form a certain image and sort toward what political end for these senators?
Well, I think that the real political end, one, is to denigrate her personally, honestly, but also to really reduce the validity of any opinions that she ultimately writes. Even though I understand that there will be many of her opinions will be dissenting opinions can carry a lot of weight, especially in future cases. Dissenting opinions can help shape reasoning even of the majority opinions, because they can push back on some ideas that the majority might have. So I am absolutely sure that they are trying to neutralize her power and importance. But I also think that there is a strategy, and I think this has been announced by Lindsey Graham, there's a strategy that they want to shape the court in their own making. Lindsey Graham has suggested that in the future, when the Republicans control the Senate Judiciary Committee, that even though the Constitution allows for the president to choose a justice for the Supreme Court, he's already signaled that they won't be allowed to even have a confirmation hearing. And so it's not far-fetched to say that, one, they may even be signaling to potential judges who are moderate or liberal that they need not even apply. In fact, I've actually talked to people who said that they would not want to have to go through a process like the one that they have seen in the past couple of weeks.
So you too, Jane, see this as a systemic chilling effect on not only the justice system, but on the future of nominations that even come before the Senate for confirmation.
I do. And I think the signal that it sent loud and clear, it's basically that from now on, there will be no Supreme Court justice who is confirmed unless the president and has the majority in the Senate.
How do you both look at this in historical terms? As you well know, the argument is that the Republican argument is you guys started it with Robert Bork, that the highly politicized confirmation process began with the confirmation hearings for Robert Bork and Ted Kennedy's accusations leveled at him and so on. Do you see that as legitimate, Anita Hill?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, when you look back at the Bork hearings, you will see that there were Republicans who joined the Democrats voting against his nomination. It wasn't as though that there was a Democratic sort of attack on an individual that, you know, no one on the Republican side agreed with. The decision not to confirm Judge Bork was bipartisan. But secondly, the attack was really on legitimate differences in constitutional interpretation. And so I don't see it as the same. But even if you say there was an attack on Robert Bork, it did not reach the depths that the attacks on Judge Jackson have reached. And I just want to be clear, if we do not understand how racism and sexism played into what became a political campaign against her, and the racism played into these tropes and myths about Blacks being soft on crime, it played into this idea that any effort to address racism is itself racist. Their attack was built on the lie that she had somehow been a part of teaching critical race theory in an elementary school. And the evidence that Ted Cruz presented was a picture book, a child's picture book.
Right.
You know, it you know, it sort of just shows the absurdity of his positioning, how far that they were willing to go. I had not a picture book waved, brandished, but in the Thomas hearing, Orrin Hatch, you know, waved a copy of The Exorcist around. Again, these kinds of tactics and approaches, none of that happened in the Bork hearing. None of that happened in the Bork hearing, but it did happen when the people that they were confronting were two Black women.
Anita Hill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we're talking about the state of the Supreme Court. Now, Jane, we just talked with Anita Hill, and I want to talk now about Justice Clarence Thomas. And I should probably say outwardly that Anita Hill prefers not to talk about Thomas after those nomination hearings so many years ago. But you've been covering the huge controversy over the political activism of Ginni Thomas, who is encouraging Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to help overturn the 2020 elections. Give us some sense, first of all, how Ginni Thomas became such a political force.
Well, she's always been a political activist, even from the time that Clarence Thomas first married her. She was working for the Chamber of Commerce and working against equal pay for women. So she's been involved on the right in politics for a very long time. But during the Trump administration, her role really grew. And it was behind the scenes for the most part. But she was trying to get meetings inside the White House, trying to meet with Trump, which she managed to do at some points, carrying lists of people that she thought he should fire. And she was becoming, you know, someone who was recently recycling some of the most fringe theories in America, including sort of QAnon theories. And what surfaced when we finally got to see her text messages to former chief of staff to Trump, Mark Meadows, were just how far out her views were and just how deeply, deeply involved she was in that effort to try to overturn the 2020 election.
Okay, but let me stop you there. What you hear in Washington in some quarters is, well, you know, this city is filled with married couples with both have political careers. Aren't people allowed in a marriage to have their own separate politics, views, no matter what you think of those views?
Yeah, and in fact, of course they are, and the critics of the critics here have sort of said, oh, this is sexist to go after Ginni Thomas, right, which is really a red herring, because nobody's saying she can't have her own views. What they're saying is a Supreme Court justice, like any other judge, is bound by, there's a specific law that says that no judge, no matter which court they sit on, it's a federal law, it says they cannot sit on a case in which their spouse has an interest in the outcome. And what we learned was from all of this was that Justice Thomas actually sat on a case that involved the January 6th investigations. And we now know his wife was part of the effort to overturn the election that is under those investigations. And so he was basically sitting on a case that involves his wife. And there are many other examples, which we did, tried to lay out in the New Yorker story of issues in which Ginni Thomas has a stake. In one case, at least, she had a financial stake. And basically, the issue is whether he should recuse. It's not an issue of whether she should have her own opinions.
And does he decide recusal on his own, or can, say, Justice Roberts say, hey, you better recuse yourself on this? How is recusal decided?
I mean, it's kind of amazing in this day and age, but the justices completely decide on their own, and there's no enforcement method over them. The Chief Justice could certainly suggest that Clarence Thomas recuse, but it hasn't been done. It's really not the sort of norm. And the Chief Justice, despite the higher title, doesn't really have any specific authority over any of the other justices' recuse.
So there's really no recourse, is there, other than the pressure of politics or embarrassment?
Well, I mean, under the Constitution, the only recourse is impeaching a Supreme Court justice. And it's only been tried once, and it was in 1804 and failed. There is actually a lot of legislation that has been suggested. Right now, there's a bill called the 21st Century Courts Act, but it only has Democratic sponsors in the Senate and the House to try to bring in some enforcement method of ethics on the Supreme Court.
Jane Mayer, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer, and we spoke also with Anita Hill, who's a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The author Jennifer Egan is out with a new book this month, and it's called The Candy House. It's a kind of follow-up to her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. And that book from 2010 won a Pulitzer Prize. Now, Candy House revisits some of the same characters, and it's definitely one of the most anticipated novels of the year. Goon Squad was largely about the music business, and that's not a surprise, because Egan herself is a tremendous music fan, and her ideas about structure and form often owe something to the albums that shaped her as a young listener. Is there
anybody out there? You know, I came of age in the great era of concept albums, and they were so literary. First of all, there were pages, there was paper. My friends and I pored over the lyrics and the images. And the very nature of a concept album is that it tells one big story in small pieces that sound very different from each other and that sort of collide.
I invited Jennifer Egan to tell us about three concept albums that may have influenced her over time. And she started in 1973. With The Who's Quadrophenia, which tells the story of a disaffected working-class kid in the 1960s.
I think Quadrophenia is really one of the greats because it tells an enormous story. It has such an epic, the music itself has such a lush, epic quality. And I think for me also, part of it was that I fell madly in love with Roger Daltrey. And so I felt that somehow England and the sort of rock and roll version of England really held my future. You know, I grew up in San Francisco. I had never left the country. And for me, this idea of getting to England and somehow merging with the world that seemed to exist there, which did include Roger Daltrey in some way, tingled as a goal for me. And it really had a huge impact. I mean, I took a gap year before college and I bought a ticket on Freddie Laker Airlines. I packed up a backpack and I went to London.
To visit Roger Daltrey.
Well,
to the doorstep.
I knew that part was a long shot.
What's your favorite track on Quadrophenia?
I think Love, Rain, or Me, which, as I recall, is actually the last one. Again, I think it's sort of, in a way, it captures my narrative impulse, which is always to try to go big if you can.
Right.
It's pretty over the top.
Totally.
But it's also, it's just a sort of wild, romantic, the ocean is crashing. And again, you have to remember that, love was part of this for me. It's just a big, epic vision. It's storytelling on the highest note. I'm sorry, what 15-year-old girl would not fall in love having heard this song? Can bring the rain that makes you young to the sky.
Only love. Okay, now we go to 1975, one of my favorites of that period, and even now she's still working, Patti Smith.
Oh, my God. I don't even know where to start with her. I mean, My two best girlfriends and I, freshman year of high school, fell in love together with Patti Smith. And it felt to me that for that year, she was the narrator of the soundtrack of my life, actually. We just would, you know, frankly, get stoned, lie on the rug, close our eyes, and listen to Horses.
So the album is Horses. What's the cut that did it for you?
Well, the song Horses is just amazing. I mean, it's a very narrative song, although what story it's telling is not completely clear. But it is just, it's a song that feels almost like a concept album in itself because so much happens narratively. And it starts with a boy who seems to be shooting up. We're not really sure, and we end in this very different place. So it's just a totally transporting, for me, piece of music to this day. It's something I listen to a lot, actually.
While stoned and on a rug.
I've kind of cut out that part, but I like to
longer.
Run to it.
Let's listen.
Her work has such a deep awareness of language as a tool, as a sound. It's just so, it has such a propulsive force to it. And the force is obviously musical, but it's also narrative. And, you know, it's certainly for A Visit from the Goon Squad and my new book, The Candy House, I'm very interested in the relationship between musical narrative and literary narrative. And Patti Smith embodies that.
How does that come to play in the new book?
Well, it's, you know, it's different in that the new book is not really about music per se, right, or the music industry in the way that A Visit from the Goon Squad is. But I found myself thinking as I moved into the new book, I was struck by certain musical tendencies that I would hear in different songs. One was by Nada Surf, which is an indie band that I really like. And in this case, I was noticing that a rhythm I hadn't been paying attention to asserts itself very gradually, and then the song ends. And I loved that. I thought, okay, how would I do that narratively? I asked myself that all the time. And then actually, I was reading an article in The New Yorker by a woman who worked in Silicon Valley.
Right, that's Anna Wiener.
Yes. And she talked about how listening to electronic dance music was the perfect soundtrack for the kind of work she was doing, which was completely screen driven. And, you know, she'd be sitting in her apartment with headphones on and listening to one song, kind of one beat yield to another. And she described the moment when the drop would occur. I remember the moment that I read that because I thought, oh, that is exactly the kind of musical principle I want to use to organize this new book that I was, you know, was just working on the beginnings of at that point.
Were you a writer, or are you a writer that only took up fiction because the rock star life wasn't going to work out? Would you have liked to have been on stage performing in that way?
No way. I can't sing. I don't play an instrument. I had a terrible public speaking fear that I had to tackle with beta blockers for some years when I first started to publish. No way. However, I have had my good times in the mosh pit, loved rock concerts, and you know, I am just a fan. That's really it. I'm a music fan.
Now, your third and final pick is who?
So my third and final pick is Eminem's Recovery. Possibly a surprising choice, but what I loved about Eminem's Recovery, which interestingly came out the same month as A Visit from the Goon Squad, my older son was then an enormous Eminem fan. He was 9, I have to hasten to say, because I think he would not like me to be telegraphing this about him. But We would often listen to music with an ear pod in each of our ears.
Young Money. Yeah.
And I, what I realized listening to Recovery was that the concept album was still alive. I don't think I had really known that. You know, there had been sort of a long gap during which I had not really thought much about the form, but I was now thinking about it because I had published a book which had used it as a genre. So I listened to Recovery and I thought, oh yeah, okay, he is absolutely telling a story in pieces that sound different from each other. And it's tremendously language-based. And of course, Eminem is a guy who has made a movie that has a soundtrack and is extremely aware of the storytelling possibilities of his work. So that was really heartening, actually, to discover.
It's a little too late to say that you're sorry now. You kicked me when I was down, but what you say just don't hurt me. That's right, it don't hurt.
Well, the new novel is just terrific, and I really appreciate your sharing your musical history and your time in the mosh pit with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan's new novel has just been released, and it's called The Candy House. She talked about The Who's Quadrophenia, Patti Smith's song Land, a selection of which is called Horses, and Eminem's Recovery. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I begin to spaz with the pen. I'm a little bit sicker than most. It's thin again, thick again. They say the competition is stiff, but I get a heart from the now stick it in. I ain't never giving in again. Cross into the wind, complete freedom. Look at these rappers, how I treat them.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Charles Mathey is a staff writer who covers politics and other subjects in Georgia and well beyond. He recently wrote about the candidates running against Marjorie Taylor Greene for her congressional seat. But this story of Charles's brings us a lot closer to home. Here's Charles Mathey.
Let me take you back in time. It's 1991. I'm 10 years old and I live in Atlanta. My obsessions include Air Jordans, the music of Naughty by Nature, and more than anything else, basketball cards.
So there was a lot of buying of cards with whatever money we had.
This is Sam. We went to elementary school together.
Was Docks
right.
a place?
Docks
you went?
Was a
that
place.
That was down Cheshire Bridge.
Cheshire Bridge, right. I remember because you pass all the adult entertainment shops, which we weren't going to, but there was a lot of conversation getting there.
One day.
With your parents.
Yeah.
On your way to collect cards when you're nine.
Sam Bathrick, mostly collected cards with Alex Cullen. They were best friends.
Now kids have Instagram and cell phones and TikTok videos, and we had basketball cards, you know.
I think Alex got me into basketball cards. If you know Alex, which you do, you know that he just kind of has this obsessive personality type.
Like, I brought basketball cards to school. I would trade basketball cards at lunchtime. You know, it was like me being a competitive spirit. I think some of it was like me wanting to be the best or have like a lot of them and have good cards, as I called them.
We were definitely very competitive about everything, and he was bigger than me and better than me at most things.
So why am I telling you all this? Well, a few months ago, Sam reached out to me. He's in a weird spot.
The situation involves basketball cards and Alex and another kid they used to know.
Zach was a really sweet kid. I mean, I just remember him being like kind of quiet, but like fun.
Sam and Alex had an edge to their friendship, always getting into scrapes. Zach Hill was a little more laid back. One day when they were about 10, Zach asked Sam over to his house.
There was a back room in his house, this little sunroom, kind of overlooking this gulch. He had a box. It was a shoebox, some kind of box. And he had been given cards from his grandfather. So I remember him opening the box. And somewhere in there, I remember seeing the card.
The card.
Topps made this card in 1980 that was a triptych. Each three players on one card, and the three players were Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and Dr. J.
So if that doesn't do anything for you, then I know you're not a big card collector. Let me explain. Cards with great players on them are valuable. And rookie cards, cards from the first season of a player's career, are also valuable. The three players on the card Sam saw at Zach's house, they're not just great, they're legends. And two of them, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, were rookies when the card was made.
Laugh like a bird! Holy cow!
The most valuable player is Magic Johnson!
Imagine somebody shows you a box of antiques they picked up at a yard sale, and they open the box. And inside is the Holy Grail. That's how Sam felt when he saw the card. It's the kind of card that could be really valuable someday. That's foreshadowing, folks.
I think at some point I must have told Alex about the card and about Zach.
Definitely sounds possible that you would have told me about it. I have some kind of vague memory that, like, you mentioning it or telling me about it, and then the idea that I would have said, like, cool, let's figure out how to get that, and framed it as, like, you and I being a team. That sounds
right.
So they hatched this plan. Sam would suggest to Zach that they pool their card collections. Once they'd done that and the cards were all mixed up, Sam would suggest they dissolve the partnership. And when the cards were dealt back out, Sam would make sure that he got the card.
My memory is, like, I knew what was happening.
What was happening?
I mean, we were taking Zach's card.
It was the perfect crime. Zach didn't even seem to realize the card was gone, and shortly afterward, he moved to a different school. The heat was off, a clean heist. But then you've got two robbers, Sam and Alex, and just one card.
It was just so seamless that it didn't even have to be considered as a plan. It was more like an inevitability. Sam got the card, and pretty quickly I started saying, you know, you should trade the card to me.
Do you remember what you traded me?
I don't.
It's because it was worthless.
Yeah, I mean, I was a businessman.
Why did I agree to that? Why did I agree to do that?
You're asking me?
Yeah. Because you must have known that I would agree to it.
I can't know the inner workings of your mind.
And I think that people tend to block out, like, the darkest memories, you know? Kind of like the times where they touch, like, the darkest parts of themselves. So that makes sense. Yeah. Why you wouldn't remember what you did to me.
Oh, I thought it was a dark moment for you. I think some of the times when I, like, pegged you with a basketball when we were playing 101 were somewhat darker and more significant.
Alex's parents saw that the card might be worth something someday, so they put it in a safe deposit box, where it stayed for the next 20 years. Sam and Alex stayed best friends. After high school, they went to different colleges, but they stayed in touch. And both ended up working in the film business.
now mid-30s. Early 30s, we sort of realized we're both doing the same kind of work as freelancers. At one point, we stopped competing and actually just realized we're business partners.
And through all this, Alex is thinking about the card.
I was like pushy around basketball cards as a kid, and you know, it was like not an easy part of our childhood, and definitely brought out some of my worst tendencies probably. And so I think I like looked at that card in particular as almost just like a symbol of like, this isn't fully mine.
At some point for my birthday, Alex just hands me the card.
Sam displayed the card proudly in his office, a symbol or something of his friendship with Alex, until last summer.
So I was on the Twitter and I saw that this Michael Jordan card had sold for like $2 million.
This was at the height of the pandemic and the collectibles market was surging.
I ended up on the Twitter page of the auction house. And right, I would say on that same page, a few down, I see the card.
I've kept following it and it got up to like $550.
Yeah, so in the end, it sold for $550.
$550,000 for the card Sam has perched over the desk in his office.
And then start thinking about it. It's like, it's not really, by these new rules, it's not really mine or Alex's.
These new rules imposed upon you by your conscience?
Yeah. Those are fun. Then I started thinking about that.
I definitely don't think giving the card back to Zach.
No.
That doesn't track.
Last year, I sat down with Alex and Sam while they tried to hammer out whether they should cut Zach in for a share of the profits.
Zach might have lost it.
He might have lost the card.
Yeah.
Have the card. It's still in the
clearly
case.
He was not a great steward of the card.
So that buys you guys some more percentage points.
Now, their card is a little faded. It's not in perfect shape. So they're pretty sure it won't bring in $550,000. But still.
Even $100,000, and we're saying if we're splitting it, I mean, that's $33,000.
When I saw how much it was worth, I definitely thought of the new Bronco I could buy. But we'd actually be giving away $13,000 each if we're doing a 50% split, right? No, 16,000. Oh, that's bigger.
Right. I feel like this is just making us look like total assholes. I mean, what would be a crazy story is you do the whole podcast and decide not to cut him in front of all the listeners.
If I'm getting a vote, yeah.
Yeah, let's
like,
do it.
It doesn't have to be complicated, like, you know. It's like, yeah, money's great, and it would be nice to have more of it. But like, there's almost something more righteous about like engaging with him before we know, and then it's like he's in it with us.
So are we going 33? Becomes
more
33 split.
Well, I mean, we did steward it, so
yeah.
So
whoa!
I'm joking. No, I think 33.
Have you guys considered, like, he might be like, man, this is really sweet of you guys to reach out and offer this, but I actually, like, don't, no worries. Like, keep it all. Then you get the money and the moral high ground.
Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, that sounds really unlikely, Charles.
Zachariah Hill, with a CH, I think.
Facebook and Google didn't have much on Zach, so we turned to an older and much more powerful form of social networking.
Italian. I definitely remember this door.
Hello. How you doing? My name's Sam Bathrick.
Hi, Sam.
Hi.
I haven't seen you in a long time.
A while.
Okay,
yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm burning some toast.
You're burning some toast. Okay.
Let me
do? You want to come in?
Or sure. Yeah, I can come in. What? I don't know if you're in the middle of something, so I know I'm just knocking. I asked my mom, should I take my shoes off?
Yes.
Okay, I don't mind it.
And just like that, Sam is back in the house where 30 years ago, he first saw the card.
I have this really distinct memory right in this room of him having a shoebox and saying that he got this from his grandfather. They were all just loose cards. And we opened it up right here. And this was one of them.
How old were you?
I think we were 8 or 9.
Oh, wow.
Sam explained the whole situation to Zach's mom, Honora.
Well, but you know, that's you were really young, and it's developing ethics. I mean, ethics are sure as hell not natural. I mean,
yeah.
They are. The kindness is natural, but with children, you know, you have to battle it all out to figure it out.
Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I would love to get Zach's number, and I'll reach out to him.
Okay, what am I doing? I'm sending you.
What you do is you go to his contact.
I knew that Kevin Johnson was awesome.
Yeah.
And you wanted my Kevin Johnson.
That's
And I remember Zach. You had a number of cards and you were trying to convince me that Benoit Benjamin really put this trade over the top. And being like, no, Benoit Benjamin is awesome. You just don't know, dude. He is awesome.
Back check.
And I remember
Benoit Benjamin was not awesome.
For some reason, that sticks out in my mind because it was like a moment of skepticism where I was like, I'm not sure about this kid.
Zach's an architect now and an amateur NBA blogger. He met Sam at a coffee shop. They live like 5 minutes away from each other. His memory of his card collection is as vivid as any of ours.
I remember the cards, they almost felt like grainy, like they had something in them to keep them dry or something like that. And there was this intense, like not exactly a new car smell, but chemical smell when you open the pack.
I remember it being the best smell ever.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably objectively not a good smell, but it was exciting.
Yeah.
But of all the cards from all those years ago, there's one that's very fresh in Zach's mind.
There was this one edition of like bubblegum cards where they had these three together that you could like rip apart or whatever. And I found a Larry Bird Magic Johnson rookie and I remember bringing it to you and us like freaking out and being like, oh my God, I can't believe we have this thing.
Do you remember who the third guy was?
I do not remember who the third guy was. Do you?
It was Dr. J.
Was it really? No shit. God, that was a really, really good basketball card.
All right, so I do have something to show you.
Yeah. Oh, is this the card? Oh, yeah, that's unbelievable. Oh, look at this.
So, how did I end up with this card?
I think probably what happened was that, you know, the sum or all of our kind of pooled collection was at your house, and I got sent to a new school and I stopped thinking about it, you know? I think that...
In my head, it's always been some version of like a bad transaction for you.
I don't remember being like, oh, this is bad in any kind of way. I was like, okay, we have all this other stuff and it's probably awesome. You know, like I didn't know.
Sam told Zach all about the card and him and Alex and the safe deposit box, which brought him to what he'd seen on Twitter.
I don't know what it's worth. The mint version of this, which this is not.
Right. Yeah, because it's faded. It's no joke.
So I don't even know if it's, you know, worth doing with this card, but the mint 10 rating version of this card just auctioned for $550,000.
No shit.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
After a few minutes, Zach calmed down.
You know, the weird thing about collectors is like there's this tension between the sort of historical or sentimental value of this thing and then the monetary value of it, right? And it's like you can do one or the other, but there's always both present.
Right.
You know, and it's like, what do you care about?
No, you're putting your finger on it.
And like the fact that I have the same object in my hand is like a weird and fascinating piece of time travel that I think is I don't know, to interest me. A lot of people would be like, you know, like, dude, go to Rome. It's fine. You know, like there's plenty of old things. But
And then after all that strategizing that Alex and Sam did, Sam just hands over the card.
Well, you should take it with you.
Okay.
And just be with it for a little while. Enjoy it. And I think I'm aligned that like there's no reason to try to sell it. So let's just like
let's not
keep the story going.
Okay.
And we got to figure out what the what
we
the
should
club.
Figure out what the club does.
I mean, we should just get our collections out and see what we got.
Okay.
So what happened there? You just changed your mind about selling the card?
Yeah, I think coming out of meeting with Honora, I was already starting to feel like this isn't about how much money we can get for this card. It's about what it means to everybody who's in this story. And then, you know, seeing Zach's face light up when he saw it, it was just like, this is what this card is here for, is for us to kind of return to these stories and return to each other. And just, it stopped even really being on the table for me.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the real ending here is I should have just kept it. That's the irony, is my evil nature should have just won out. We all might have been better off for it if I just kept it in a lockbox the whole time.
One afternoon, I asked Zach if I could borrow the card. I wanted to take Sam to go find out what it was worth.
So yeah. See, the blue on Magic Johnson didn't really fade, but the pink border did.
Yeah.
So that is gonna hurt the grading. So
top end, not 1,000.
I think your top end would be probably in the 1,000 to 1,500 range. Yeah.
You might think Sam would be disappointed, but being in the card shop after all this time seemed to have the opposite effect.
I just bought 10 packs of 1990 Fleer. Like unopened packs of 90 Fleer cards. So I'm looking forward to just starting all over. Starting it all back up.
Sam Bathrick of Atlanta, talking with The New Yorker's Charles Bethet. I'm David Remnick, and that's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, staff writer Hilton Alls joins us with the playwright Michael R. Jackson, who wrote the new musical A Strange Loop. I hope you'll join us. Have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Mengfei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine.
Original music in this week's show was composed by Alex Barron.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.